Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Shrine of Remembrance. My name is Leonie Pratt. I am the Manager of Education, Marketing and Community Programs. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which the shrine is built, their elders, both past and present. I would also like to acknowledge the attendance of any veterans and or current servicemen and women who are here today, and we welcome you. As is tradition here at the Shrine, and before commencing today's event, let us please take a moment to honour the service and sacrifice of all Australian servicemen and women. For those of you that are able, would you please stand? They shall grow not old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them. Lest we forget. Thank you. Please be seated. As you entered today, you would have received a copy of our What's On program for January to June this year. You'll find information here about our upcoming public programs, ceremonies, and our Friends program. I would just like to mention next week we have our next public program. It's on Tuesday, the 4th of March, also starting at 12:30. It's titled A Woman's Perspective, The Work of Women in War, and will present the stories of two ladies who, when the Second World War was declared, each contributed to the wartime effort in different ways. It's a meaningful topic for anyone who is interested in the significant contribution of Australian women in wartime. As we're about to start today's program, I'd like to remind you that all our public programs are recorded and they are available for download off our website or through iTunes. But today, we're very pleased to welcome our guest speaker, Dr. Jennifer Lawless. Dr. Lawless is currently the manager of the History Curriculum in New South Wales. She was awarded a Churchill Fellowship to research the best practice in the teaching of primary history in Canada, Britain and Scotland. Dr. Lawless was granted two Australian Military History Scholarships and an Endeavour Fellowship to research the topic of today's talk. Her research took her not only to places in Australia, but also in Britain and in Turkey. Many of the Turkish sources have never been translated into English, and today's talk is based on 10 years of research of Australian, British and Turkish archives. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lawless.
Thank you so much for the invitation to speak at the Melbourne Shrine of Remembrance. It's a great honour, and thank you all for coming. Now, basically, starting off with our Gallipoli prisoners of war, despite the great attention focused on Gallipoli, I was quite surprised to find an area that hardly had been touched. And to me, this was a great neglect of the experiences of some of the Australians who fought at Gallipoli. And when I started to research it, it surprised me actually how neglected this aspect had been. Now, the photograph here that we have was a central part of that story. It's the town of Afyon Karahisar in central Turkey, just generally referred to as Afyon. And this photograph was taken round about the time that our men were there in World War One, and a very, very chilly scene it looks too, very, very cold in winter. And this was a scene of quite a few of the stories that came about from the men. As was said before, the research took 10 years, and I really didn't think I'd ever find a topic that would engage me for so long. I didn't go looking for a topic on Gallipoli. My background is in ancient history, and I was quite happy to keep my interest in ancient history until one night, and it was a serendipitous find, I suppose, that one night in Istanbul, walking home after a very long social evening with my husband, he suggested that nearby was a British military cemetery. Now, I couldn't imagine why it was in Kadıköy on the south shore of Istanbul. What on earth was a military cemetery doing there? But anyway, he was adamant that it did exist, so the next morning off we went. And there I found 9 graves of young Australians in a beautifully kept military cemetery. And it was obvious that those young men had fought at Gallipoli in 1915. If they had been at Gallipoli, I started to ask, why on earth were they buried here? It's quite a distance from Gallipoli, obviously. So on my return, the search began and turned into a PhD topic, and 10 years later, finally, I was able to tell the story. But along the way, I found that there were various myths that had developed over the years on this topic, and particularly strange when there'd been so little research done. Several historians had maintained that very few Australians survived the Turkish camps and came home. It was also thought by many that Turkey did not adhere to any international convention on the battlefield or the treatment of POWs. It had been stated by some that the deaths of the POWs was due to overwork, harsh punishment, starvation, and total neglect. And when they left Turkey, that they were skeletons. And that, of course, led to the assumption that their treatment by the Turks was similar to that under the Japanese in World War II. And as also both groups at one stage worked on railway construction. So who were these young men who became the first Australian POWs in World War I? They were mostly amongst the first recruits to sail from Australia and obviously oblivious to their fate for the next 4 years. Overall, there were 67 verified Australians captured at Gallipoli, not many. And so far we have located 122 elsewhere from other Middle Eastern fronts. They came from all regions of Australia and from all sectors of society. Clerks from Geraldton in Western Australia, labourers from Avoca in Victoria, tradesmen from Sydney. Almost half were either born or enlisted in Victoria, so Victorians were very much a focus. The majority were Australian born, though there was still a fair proportion who had been born in Britain, and obviously in the initial wave of enthusiasm to go to the war, I think what they thought was a trip home, a free trip home, was quite an incentive. And they ranged in age from 18 to 45. I suppose if there was going to be a typical POW, based on statistics, he would be an unmarried 24-year-old Australian-born Victorian labourer with no previous military experience. This is one of my favourites. He was Victorian, not quite typical of the norm, but Lieutenant Leslie Luscombe was a 23-year-old railway clerk from Geelong, and he later wrote his autobiography, The Story of Harold Earle, and it's really a very, very interesting account of the officer experience, and it's a shame that his book and has not featured in any other research on the POWs. And he featured quite remarkably throughout my research because he was a very, very balanced and very, very intelligent observer of what was happening. So who returned? Was it only a few that were able to return? Of the 67 verified Australian captives from Gallipoli, 43 returned to Australia. So approximately 2/3 of them came back. 24 didn't return home. 12 died very soon after capture from their battle wounds, and some of them, obviously, to be captured, were quite badly wounded to start with. And they died in either Turkish field hospitals or hospitals in Istanbul. 11 who went on to the camps died of various epidemics that swept through Turkey during the war. Mostly typhoid, dysentery or influenza. And one unfortunate young man died from an accidental rock fall when he was asleep in his bunk and a rock had been dislodged from the hill above by his fellow workers and he was crushed to death. So the claim that actually few returned is not correct. Two-thirds did make it back. But what were their experiences on capture? Generally, soldiers were very fearful of capture, and rightly so. Some British officers had encouraged the belief that Turks did not recognise nor practice laws of warfare, and that they mutilated captured soldiers. In fact, the Turkish War Office had published a booklet, Regulations for the Treatment of POWs, in 1914, that was based very closely on the Hague Convention of 1907, and we were able to locate that in the Turkish archives and translate it into English for the first time. And I suppose I've been very, very lucky, and he's going to be very embarrassed by this, of having a husband who describes his degree as that useless bloody degree, actually, that's been very, very useful because it involved the ability to translate Ottoman Turkish. So he was often shoved into archives while I went shopping. And you can't really say that as a researcher, but that's what often happened, because sometimes some of the archives I couldn't get into because I didn't have the language. So he was very, very useful. So thank you. And so ingrained, though, were these negative attitudes to the Turks on initial landing, that on the first day of landing, when a Turkish soldier was captured, the response from some of the men following was, "Shoot the bastard." And at times that attitude continued. On the very first day of landing, six Australians were captured. And it seems the Turks at first weren't sure what to do with these men, because they spent several hours marching from different field hospitals or headquarters behind the lines, behind the Turkish lines, for some time until they could figure out what on earth to do with them. Very few were captured during May, and the majority, 34, were captured during that ill-fated offensive of the 8th and the 9th of August on Hill 971. Unluckily, the last Australian to be captured was on the 20th of December, the day Australians evacuated the peninsula. Captain Goodwin was a spotter on a British plane that was ditched into the sea, and he was able to swim ashore and was rescued by a Turkish contingent, and unfortunately the British pilot drowned. So basically what happened to the wounded and to the other prisoners when they were first captured? Now obviously this is a Turkish photograph of the Turkish stretcher bearers, etc., and obviously a nicely posed one. But basically, the wounded were picked up by the Red Crescent stretcher bearers and taken to field hospitals. The others were placed in tents and provided with food. The wounded were treated by Turkish and German medical staff. They were generally initially well treated and provided with cigarettes, and this always gets to me, that whenever they had visitors in the hospitals desperately ill, the visitors would bring cigarettes. Wouldn't go over well today. When being treated in a field hospital, Private Daniel Creedon was visited regularly by a Turkish clerk and several Turkish officers, who found him apparently quite amusing. In his diary he wrote, "And there was one doctor who attended to us and our wounds, and we were progressing very well under his treatment." There were mixed reactions, of course, from some of the Turkish soldiers and the citizens on the peninsula. There are several occasions when some prisoners were threatened by soldiers, but their guards protected them. Often guards showed considerable kindness to the men, and Creedon again commented, The sentry who came with me was a very jolly chap and was very kind to me, seeing that I had plenty of water and cigarettes. The cart in which he travelled was often stopped for them to have a look at me. As Privates John Beattie and Charles McLean were being escorted across the battlefield after they had been captured to be interrogated, they were warned by their Turkish captors to remove their Aussie hats in case Turkish snipers shot them. And Sergeant Morris Delprat recorded an incident with a Turkish tea shop owner on his journey from the battlefield to Istanbul. "We had travelled for 3 days in a wagon," he said, "and I'd been a week without tea. He gave us such a large enamel mugful. We turned out our pockets to show that we wouldn't be able to pay him. But the old fellow told us, or at least we thought he did, that Allah was shouting. The names of each prisoner was recorded by the Turks, and whether or not they had been admitted to hospital on capture, and they also named the actual field hospitals where the men were taken. The translations of these records was made very difficult, of course, as Ottoman handwriting is very difficult to read, doesn't generally use vowels, so the names of the captives took some time to decipher, and I'm afraid a lot of rather rude words coming from my translator, who sometimes has to resort to a magnifying glass to be able to locate one tiny dot that would change the whole meaning. Later, the details of each were forwarded on to the International Red Cross via the American Embassy, and then on to the British War Office. The information was shared with the Australian Red Cross POW Department in London, led by the dauntless Miss Elizabeth Cholmley, and she's certainly a woman that deserves a lot of research later on. Quite often, the men were photographed, and this is a photograph of the two Aussies in the middle, and the one on the left, the third from the left, and beside him, Maurice Delprat. We're still not quite sure about the one on the left, on the third from the left. I think it's probably Mr. Allen. But the one on the right is definitely Maurice Delprat, the one of the enamel tea drinker. But they were photographed quite often, and this is one of the few actual photographs that we've been able to find taken of them on capture. But what is quite interesting is that Delprat still got his full uniform, he still got his hat firmly on his head, and looking in reasonable condition. The problem with the interrogation, of course, was that they were sometimes in French, generally in Turkish, and so of course they didn't get very far. But they were done in accordance with international convention. The prisoners were asked to write their name, their rank and battalion. Sergeant Sidney Drake stated that whilst questioned by two Turkish officers, I was seated at a table and given tea and cigarettes and was treated in a very hospitable manner. Responses to interrogation questions were recorded, and often the Turks received strange replies, and you can again see the Australian, I suppose, humour coming out. One Turkish interrogator wrote, I asked one of the prisoners, why did you come here all the way from Australia? And he replied, sport. Some gave outlandish answers. One Turkish record related the following. According to these prisoners' statements, the enemy was both morally and physically demoralised, and in addition to the scarcity of food due to lack of water, they were forced to drink their own blood by biting their wrists. One would hope, one assume that that was a bit of an exaggeration. Once captured, the men were often in danger of British bombing of towns and hospitals. One prisoner, Lance Corporal Brooke, was severely wounded after a British bombing attack on the Madoss Hospital, and he later died of his wounds. After several days in makeshift camps, those who were not badly wounded were then shipped to Istanbul, generally by ship at night to avoid bombing, or a few went by train. When they first marched through the city, curious crowds watched. Corporal George Kerr noted that the crowds reacted without any of that jeering that would have characterised an English crowd under the same circumstances. So what were their experiences as captives of the Turks? Now initially, the wounded in Istanbul were placed in very good hospitals and where they were treated very well. Members of the US and Dutch embassies were allowed to visit and to bring comforts, which again generally meant more cigarettes. Sergeant William Bailey was placed in Chapa Hospital, still operating today in Istanbul as a hospital, quite a lovely building, which he said compared favourably with British hospitals. We were well fed and medical and surgical treatment was of the best. At Maltepe Hospital, Creedon commented, I was sorry to leave this ward, as I had made friends with the Turks there. And doubtless that would have been rather a difficult task, because at that stage Creedon commented also that he had no Turkish whatsoever. Later conditions deteriorated under reprisal treatment, as the Turkish government had complained to the British War Office of the poor treatment of Turkish prisoners in Egypt. This complaint was ignored by the British, so reprisal conditions were introduced to Allied POWs. During this time, conditions were poor, and the men complained of bed bugs, lice, poor food and treatment. These conditions lasted for approximately 2 months in 1915. And perhaps poor conditions at this time could have exacerbated the conditions of those who were still being treated as severely wounded prisoners. And unfortunately, 9 men died in hospital of their wounds, and some of these were very severely wounded when they were first brought in. They were provided with a military escort to the Christian cemetery at Feriköy in Istanbul. The burial service was conducted by a Christian minister, and staff from the American embassy also attended. And this cemetery can still be visited, and it's a very quiet little oasis in the middle of Istanbul. And the Christian chapels, both Protestant and Catholic, are still there. And it's quite a lovely little sanctuary, I suppose, from the madness of Istanbul traffic on the other side of the wall. Now, what happened once they got to camps? This is an original postcard. We were able to find it in a second-hand bookshop in Istanbul. And what they did was that I'd go round to the various camps taking photographs of the men and then selling it back to them as postcards. So quite a clever way of raising money, I guess. But they are now quite rare, as you can imagine. We're very, very lucky to have found that one. And if you look carefully, you can see a couple of Aussie hats amongst that lot. The majority, of course, are British prisoners. After only a few weeks in Istanbul, most of the prisoners were transported by train to a range of camps in the interior of Turkey. There are approximately 20 in all. Officers and men were separated. Officers were not required to work, as required by the Hague Convention, and the lower ranks were paid at the Turkish rate of pay for the work performed. And at the camps, they were housed in a variety of buildings. They weren't the usual prisoner of war camps we envisage, you know, with the surrounded by watchtowers and barbed wire. They were generally in schools, churches, mosques, private houses and barracks. So they had there was a range of different accommodations there. What we have here is the centre of Afyon, that where we first began, the first photograph. And in the middle is the major mosque, and to the right of that is the madrasa, or the religious school, that was used initially as their accommodation in Afyon. And several men described the conditions of that. One of the problems was that there was only 2 toilets in the building, and they got a lot of overuse by the descriptions. We also had some of the houses that the council at Afyon are keen to locate some of these areas because it tells such a story of the prisoners. They're trying to locate some of these houses, and we have been able to locate a few of them. And we actually have a photograph, which unfortunately I didn't put in, of 4 of the officers standing outside these very houses. And it was very exciting, actually, to find them. Because the officers actually paid rent, and that was later waived, but they actually lived in private homes. They weren't held in any sort of actually enclosed camp itself. This is another one too, at San Stefano, a suburb in Istanbul. And this was a monastery, and that also was a place where many were kept, the ones who were kept in Istanbul and not in the interior of Turkey. And when we went there, it was unfortunate that the current staff there knew nothing of that story, and yet we have beautiful descriptions of them playing football outside in the park, which is still there by the water. So it was rather wonderful to be able to locate that. It actually, we travelled 8,000 kilometres around Turkey, locating all of the campsites, and there was still evidence in some places of where they were. And it was just wonderful to sit down and read the descriptions of the men sitting in that site. One of the most important buildings, of course, was always the bathhouse. And you just wonder what Aussies, particularly from the country, thought of the Ottoman bathhouses when they were first introduced. Prisoners in the small camps, as I said, did work. And one of the works was at Kadıköy, where my whole adventure began, where they built the jetty there. That's no longer standing, but they actually built the jetty, and were again lucky enough to find the postcard of that for sale. So often conditions depended too on the relationship, obviously, between the camp commandant and the prisoners. This varied from one commandant at Afyon in 1916, who was hated by the men and who was removed, to others who were very well regarded. Obviously, initially, there were many cultural misunderstandings, at least at first. Australians had often shouted Arabic words across the trenches at Gallipoli, some rather rude ones, apparently learnt in Egypt, and assuming that the Turks initially spoke Arabic. Gradually, the men learnt some basic Turkish words and phrases, and several of the officers became very, very fluent. Food was initially an issue, as you can imagine. At first, they were served the same diet as Turkish soldiers. Just a little meat, stews of burgle and vegetables, lentils and beans. At first, they thought they were being fed food, what you would feed fowls on, one said. And they thought that was part of the punishment. Often food was served communally in a large dish, and the men, of course, took exception to this and didn't like it. However, once in the camps, they were able to organise themselves into different messes to purchase and prepare their own food. And there's lists of some of the cooking utensils they went out to the markets to buy and to bring back. And as they were paid for their work, obviously not much, but in Turkish terms, so they were able to purchase materials, they also received money from home and the Red Cross. So as they settled in, they were much better off. What is surprising, which really was quite a shock, I think, was that alcohol was often a source of conflict, obviously, between prisoners and guards in the camps. Many commandants berated the men for drunken behaviour and for fights, which often resulted from overindulgence. There were many examples of drunken prisoners put into cells overnight to sober up. And at the railway camp of Belimedik, which was run by a German group of engineers who were building the Berlin to Baghdad railway, there were occasions when guards were attacked when they came to escort the men home from the local inn. And it's not kind of behaviour that one would normally come across. Turkish alcohol was severely criticised for its quality, but this obviously didn't stop its consumption. Kerr noted at Afyon, "It would seem that we're not being treated too badly when it is possible to get drunk." And on occasions, some of them got drunk week after week. Officers had a broader range of alcohol to choose from. Raki, Balkan wine, Smyrna beer and local brandy, all remarkably bad, said one officer. Again, didn't stop them. One man who made a considerable difference to the conditions of camps was the official War Ministry camp inspector, Colonel Zaya Bey. He made many visits to the various camps, insisting on better conditions and removing several camp commandants who were poor or neglectful administrators. He made up lists of camp rules to improve conditions, and the officers often treated him to dinner parties and concerts when he visited. This is the railway camp at Belimedik. It's in the middle of the Taurus Mountains in a very, very rugged region. Quite beautiful, actually, and there's still several houses that exist, and of course the railway line. But this was quite an interesting camp, and this is where the majority worked for their time in Turkey. They worked alongside both Turkish and German workers and were paid similar rates as the Turkish workers, and several actually received much higher rates than that. Some of the prisoners held positions of great responsibility and were paid well above the normal Turkish wages. Corporal Kerr held a responsible clerical position in the office here at Bellamedic, with his own living quarters, a servant, and 13 clerical staff to supervise. Bellamedic was also very surprising in that the men could go to various restaurants. Some mentioned going to a new restaurant at Bellamedic for their birthday, and various entertainments for the men, including a cinema that showed apparently terribly grainy German-American westerns, which sounded pretty terrible, but the men were very happy to go along and be entertained, but also a brothel, which again is not one which one would expect to be having experiences at a prison of war camp. What's interesting along that whole area of the Taurus Mountains is the tunnels and the railway and the viaducts were built by the prisoners, and they're still being used. And I've still yet to catch a train along there, but I will. That's an adventure. But it really is quite a beautiful area, and they're still there. When they talk about tunnel working on Tunnel 14, etc., they can still be located. The honorary German consul in Adana several years ago was hoping to actually restore much of that camp in memory of the German engineers and the workers, and several of them, of course, quite a few of them died of some of the epidemics that swept through the region, so he wants to work on that. Now, when you look at the men from Bellamedic, and there are many, many photographs, some wonderful photographs in the War Memorial collection, of the different photographs. A bit hard to see the second dog, but there's two dogs there, and they always had pets, and the Turks couldn't quite understand their need for pets. They had quite a menagerie. But basically, they were able to receive money, as I said before, from the Red Cross, as well as food parcels and other comforts. These were transported by the Turkish Postal Service, and there were often long delays. Some clothing was initially provided by the Turks, but later the Red Cross, the US and Dutch embassies provided boots, hats and suits, often resulting in a very odd assortment, as seen here. And the photographs, I think it's rather interesting when you see the collection of different hats they wore, the different suits. They often said that when new boots arrived, you know, it took them ages to find and to swap things that fitted them. And one young man, who was apparently 6'2", said, "Never mind, maybe next time I'll get a suit that fits." And he was complaining that his pants suits came to halfway down, just below his knee. But as you can see, generally, they certainly don't look skeletal, they certainly don't look starved. One of the main issues for prisoners, particularly for officers who didn't work, was of course boredom. Day after day of the same routine wore away at them. They arranged concerts and plays. They became very, very creative. They established libraries, played cards, learnt languages, and some of the lectures that were held on a range of topics was quite astounding. They went on nature walks, and one camp built up a library of over 800 books. It'd be interesting to see what happened to them when they left. Some of the prisoners learnt a reasonable level of conversational Turkish. Officers at Gediz, or it's now called Eski Gediz, accompanied local Turks on hunting expeditions and congregated at the local tea house afterwards. And when we were there, we had a delightful old man who had recorded a lot of the oral history of Gediz. And he took us to the tea house under the big tree where they used to congregate. We visited the bathhouse. We visited so many areas that he'd say, "Do your men tell you the stories of here? This is where they came to their bathhouse." I'd say, "Yes, they mentioned the bathhouse. And this is where they did this, that and the other." And I'd say, "Yes, our men recorded that as well." And it was just so exciting to be able to share those experiences. This is an interesting one. Not what one would expect. Now, camp commandants and guards often attended the many plays and concerts presented by the officers. This Sonia was a young British officer who starred in one of their plays. And so it is said, the story goes, had a disturbing effect on some of the officers. I suppose it would after 3.5 years of incarceration. But what was even more interesting is that the dress was made by Sir Leonard Woolley, who went on to excavate the ancient city of Ur. He was one of the leading British archaeologists of the 20th century. And he described this dress as primrose netting over Vio rose. And our Leonard actually sewed that. So, you know, they had some incredible props that they would... incredible work that went into some of these plays was quite outstanding. And all of the village would come to see these plays. Another interesting story are the boots and the drum, and there's also a clarinet. The stories at this Geddes, and this was a town for officers, so obviously the conditions, you know, were better than for the lower ranks. But the local town band lent a cornet, a drum, and marching boots to the prisoner of war band. And the band used to march up and down the street, apparently outside the commandant's office, playing British marching songs. And he used to, in his turn, lean out of the window and conduct them. So there was a little bit of, I suppose, political argy-bargy going on there. But when we discussed this story with Mr. Pinar, he said, I have a treasure for you. And we went down into the basement of the local council chambers at Geddes, and here were the marching boots and the drum and the cornet still there. I'm hopeless. I cried. He cried. So that was embarrassed. But it was a great find. The lower ranks worked and were more prone to the various epidemics, of course, that raged through Turkey in the war years. At times, there was insufficient fuel for heating, and tents for housing, particularly in the itinerant camps that were along the railway, were a challenge. They often leaked, they were cold, and they were crowded. But generally, when they were brought back into Bella Medic, they wouldn't be in the tents along these itinerant camps for long, several weeks at a time, and they would come back to Bella Medic. But of course, at times, it was a challenge. And obviously, punishment was a source of conflict and was resented by the men. Three Australians of our 67 were punished in the typical fashion of the Turkish army at the time, which was by flogging and being placed in a cell for a number of days, which didn't make them very happy. And we're back at Afyon. And Afyon Karahisar refers to the poppy fields that surrounded them. And they were opium officially made as pain relievers during the war. And this photo again was taken during the time of World War I with the great rock that basically dominates Afyon, and it's just a really quite a very, very interesting town. When the armistice was declared in Turkey on the 30th of October 1918, within 2 weeks the majority of the Allied POWs had been moved out of the camps and had left Turkey. It was a very, very efficient removal of the prisoners, and most of them ended up either in Smyrna or in Istanbul and were awaiting the ships that came to take them away. But within 2 weeks the majority had left. Those men who had died of their battle wounds, originally buried at Ferikoy that we looked at in from Istanbul, were later reinterred at Haider Pasha Cemetery on the southern shore of Istanbul, where my whole story began. Most of those buried at the various campsites, the ones who had died of the various diseases that swept Turkey in that time, were reburied at Northgate Cemetery in Baghdad in 1927. Several others, buried at Ankara, could not be individually identified and remain in the Armenian Christian Cemetery there at Ankara. So the various myths that grew from the time of World War I about the POW experience, that their treatment was brutal and similar to the experiences of Australian POWs held by the Japanese in World War II, are not really accurate. At times, food and accommodation were not up to the standards that Australians were accustomed to, obviously. They found themselves in a war-torn country, battling itself to survive. Hospital treatment, particularly in the remote rural areas, was often basic, lacking in supplies, and at times unhygienic. But the Australian prisoners, if they were hospitalised, were given the same treatment as the Turkish prisoners, and sometimes commenting that the food was better. The winter of 1917 was particularly harsh, and there were many comments about the coldness of that and the lack of heating. However, camp life became much more bearable once prisoners could shop and cook for themselves and receive parcels from home or those supplied by the various embassies. Improvements were also made by official visits by the International Red Cross, who visited the camps, the Red Crescent, who did also, and American and Dutch embassy officials. And there are also some suggestions very early by some historians that the Turkish camps were closed to international agencies, and that wasn't the case. I've been able to map right across all camps and map those visits by the Red Cross, the Red Crescent, the American and Dutch embassy officials, etc. And they made considerable changes, though the greatest changes were made by the actual Turkish War Office inspector, Zaya Bey, who was able to actually sack commandants and replace them. Both captives and captors often regarded the other with a total lack of understanding, exacerbated by the language barrier and the cultural differences. And what was sad is that on their return, some former prisoners exaggerated their treatment, as some were made to feel that their experiences were less worthy than those soldiers who went on to fight in the Western Front. And so many of them felt that they had let the side down, that in some ways they were failures because they had been captured and that they had been in a camp while their mates went on to fight and quite often die on the Western Front. And there were several examples of when they attended welcome home parties that they were always the last ones to be mentioned. And I'm sure that made quite an impact. So despite so much being written on Gallipoli, I hope that the story of the men who spent their 3.5 or more years in Turkey will not be forgotten. Over the 10 years it took to research this topic, mere names began to appear as real men, my boys, and most of them were in their 20s, so young. And I wish I'd been able to commence my research in the 60s or the 70s, when so many of those who returned home were still alive, and there were several I visited their graves, living into their late 80s, one into 90. Only recently I had the privilege of speaking to the granddaughter of one of my favourites, Maurice Delprat, here in Melbourne, and I hope that other relatives will eventually come forward to fill in the many gaps I still have about their lives on their return. So thank you. Got time for questions?
Yes, we do.
I think we got a bit of time for questions before we have a much needed afternoon tea. Yes.
Does sound pretty nice place to have been for the war, I must say. I wonder whether there are any escapes or attempted escapes by prisoners.
There certainly were. Several of the British officers managed to escape, and I didn't really focus on them because I was focusing on my blokes. Lieutenant White, Captain White, actually escaped and got into Russia. And there was a couple of the lesser ranks who also escaped, got down to Adana on the coast, and were away probably for about 7 days, and then were recaptured and put back to camp. They had been told that, you know, if there's escapees, they'll be shot, etc. They'll just taken back. Several disappeared overnight and then thought, well, this is not much chop, you know, it was cold and they were missing whatever the they were missing at camp and returned back and weren't even noticed that they were gone. But yes, there were some quite very adventurous escapes, particularly by some of the British officers. Yes, and they're quite interesting tales. You know, of course, for the lesser ranks, you know, it was a challenge, the food, the cold, you know, and organising themselves, but not nearly as bad as was first thought. Thank you.
Did those who were the mariners who were captured, are they in your captured at Gallipoli figures or captured elsewhere figures?
Sorry, which ones?
Those who are in the A1 or 2, whichever one.
No, not the Gallipoli ones, no. I've included those in the 122 from elsewhere. And the majority of those too were British. So in some cases, when there was a mixture of Australian and British, I kept the British out of the statistics because they're obviously included in the British statistics. But no, good point, good question.
Thank you very much. This is a talk I've been waiting to hear for a while. I'll just follow on from Lieutenant Colonel's question. One of the AU2 crew was Michael Williams from Dunkell, Western Victoria, and he actually died at Belamedic. And I tried to find his grave. He wasn't one of the ones who were taken across to northern Iraq. He's still there in Belamedic, but I couldn't find his grave. So maybe our common project next time around.
Okay. Actually, what's interesting is that Bean, when he passed through there in 1919, the train stopped there and he hopped out because he'd been told by a British officer that there were some Australian graves, and he found some. So I think we might be able to locate them because it was described that they were on a hill above the Turkish cemetery there and above the German cemetery. So I'm sure we'll find them. I'd love to find all of them, actually.
Dr. Lawless, thank you for your presentation this afternoon. Can I ask two questions? Firstly, in 1918, a report was commissioned to the House of Lords on the mistreatment of British prisoners of war in Turkey, and it's quite a scathing report in terms of mistreatment, and basically British soldiers had to sell everything they had in order to survive, and a quote that I remember was that they were treated like beasts. How does that differ to the Australian experience, and was there a difference in treatment between the British and the Australian prisoners of war at the time? And secondly, looking at that photo of Afyon, that's where my grandfather was born in 1915, and you referred to prisoners of war being deported to the interior of Turkey, of course at which time the Ottoman Empire was perpetrating the Armenian genocide. Did any of the POWs that you researched witness the massacres or mistreatment of the ethnic minorities in the Ottoman Empire?
That has been a point that's been raised by some, and they referred to a reference in Daniel Creedon's diary that somebody had told him that Armenians had been killed. Now, that's one of the closest references to witnessing genocide that there is. And to get back to your first question, that's a very interesting report, the British one, and when you go through that carefully, charge by charge, it is a gross misrepresentation. They point out that there was hardly any international agencies allowed to visit, which of course is not true. I have documented at least four major visits by international agencies. They were out to punish the Turks, and it is one of the cleverest pieces, I think, of political propaganda that I have read, particularly when you look at what was actually happening in the camps. And very interesting if you juxtapose that with actually what the men were saying at the individual camps. And what I did was to make sure that I was able to follow where every man was in a camp at the same time and verify what each was saying. And it was so obvious then if some would exaggerate their conditions when others, you know, were saying something totally different. So I think that is a very, very clever piece of propaganda. Remember, at that stage, at the end of the war, Britain moved into Turkey. It was an occupied country. And there are other documents from the War Office saying we are going to punish them, and they certainly did. So thank you for your question.
I've got to use my voice, I've got quite a strong voice. Doctor, thank you for a very good presentation. I'm interested to know, a little bit in reverse, did the Australian troops take Turkish prisoners? And if so, was there an exchange system set up at any stage, or how they treated
them? They tried to set up an exchange program that went on and on, dragged on for years, and I don't think that actually ever came to fruition. But there were a lot of complaints about the treatment of the Turkish prisoners in Egypt in particular. And what was interesting about those camps, that they actually rounded up a lot of Turkish citizens in Egypt and placed women and children in concentration camps too. So that's the next project, I hope, because they did capture them. The majority captured in Gallipoli was sent down to Egypt, and there were a lot of complaints. But that's going to be quite a lot of sifting out of information, because I think there's a lot of misinformation, there's a lot of exaggeration, but there's also a lot of Turkish material on that that'll be. Means someone will be put back into the archives to translate. Yes.
Thank you very much for this very informative talk. You've really shed some light on a very unexplored corner of this very, very much explored subject. I wonder if in your research you have also found much evidence of the prisoner of war's observation of life outside their camps. Like, they were talking about their conditions, how they were treated and what they ate, etc. But what was their perception of the war that was going outside the camp, and the conditions of the locals who were really also suffering quite a bit? Mm. Did you have much evidence of that in your research?
Particularly the officers who had much more freedom of movement were commenting on life outside, but they were generally put into areas that I suppose were better off, in rural, quite rich agricultural areas. Some of the others would note that obviously, there were shortages at times of food, of fuel, and the epidemics also. They commented that quite often the Turkish population were dying at a greater rate than they were. But in a lot of cases of the actual lower ranks, there wasn't a lot of opportunities, I suppose, of, you know, observing that. But they did make comments on them. They did comment that conditions were very, very poor, mostly. They didn't get a lot of information about the actual, what was happening in the war, in the war fronts. They were given sometimes newspapers in German. They'd sometimes be able to grab something from Turkish. But it was only when new captives came in that they would get a bit of an update. So quite often, you know, they were left pretty isolated and not knowing really what was happening. Okay, is it time
for... Last one,
to achieve that freedom of movement that you spoke about, were the officers required to give an assurance of their parole? Tommy White, in his book, agonises a bit about whether he should escape or not following giving an assurance of not escaping if they're given certain freedoms.
Mm. Some of them were and some of them weren't. And a couple of them said, oh, well, we refused to give parole and we were punished. But there's no evidence of that from the others. In Geddes, some of them gave parole, others didn't. It didn't seem to affect them very much. And I think too, when you look at where Geddes was located in some of those towns, it would take hell of an effort to escape. And so some of those escape attempts really were quite dramatic. But generally, I think they looked at where they were and thought, well, where the hell would we go?
I would like to echo everyone's comments here. What a wonderful piece of research, and thank you for your insights today, Dr. Lawless. After 10 years of research, I'm sure there are so many more stories that you could tell, so hopefully we could get you back. Everyone, we would like to wrap that up here, and we will have tea and coffee and some biscuits, and that might also be an opportunity for some of you to talk to Dr. Lawless. Thank you again for coming. On behalf of the Shrine, thank you, and as a token of our appreciation, we have a small gift for you, Dr. Lawless.
Thank you.
Everyone, look forward to seeing you again. Thank you.
Thank you very much.